Blog Talk Radio.
Jimmy Maxton, James McDiddle, Bob Bernalligan and McShane, Agnes Dolan, Helen Crawford, Puff McNeith, great John McLean. These are some of the red lights I'd have hundreds more and wish to name. A monument that reigns forever, these are the flower of Scotland's fame. McDougall fell apart in prison, came back with a broken shell. He did the same to young John Muir, 8 life months in the jaws of hell. His only crime was saying no to slaughter in the rich man's war. Property is theft, he said, don't die for what you can heal. And for tax and tax for common folk, self for money lender, the old church pew, the white and blue, the Celt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear, it's for thread the red white ciders. Every Sunday night at Bath Street, John McLean roared to his spiel. Thousands gathered round to hear him. He spoke loud and he spoke well. 15 years I've been a soldier, fighting far in the cause, he said. Oh, no, stop now, no, you might jail me. Prison walls at any dread. John was lifted for sedition. Muir and Gallagher, Maxton too. Ah, the leader so red twice, I trotted out for public view. While others flagged and begged for mercy, John threw caution to the wind. You stand accused, he told the judge, with the blood of millions on your hands. Rags and tax for common folk, some for money lender, the old church pew, the white and blue, the Celt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear, it's what's said in the red white ciders. Torture by the screws in prison, force-fed with the poison food, haunted, shattered, still not broken. Up on the kirk he proudly stood. That night when John James came to Glasgow, weak of body, white of hair, red light burned as bright as midday. Then the tanks rolled through the square. Workers' blood splashed over the flagstones. Soldiers came with tanks and guns. Beaks were broken, spirits too. The final chapter had begun. That treachery on Bloody Friday sent a stench to Heaven's Gate. John said, we'll build our own republic. The fight for justice can he wait. Rags and tanks for common folk, self for money lenders. The old church pew, the white and blue, the Celt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what tread in the red plane ciders. Jimmy Maxton, James McDougall, Barbara Gallagher and McShane, Agnes Dolan, Helen Crawford, hundreds more I'd wish to name. Above them all, by heathen shoulder, stood the Dominie by the shores. John McLean, the pride of Glasgow, he gave his life for the common cause. Rags and tags for common folk, some for money lender. The old church pew, the white and blue, the Celt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what's tread in the red white ciders.
Well, it's a beautiful Saturday noon for a change in Kansas. Yes, it's welcome. I'm your host, Michael Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. This one's for the books. Yes, you want to keep it. You'll want to keep this one. It is certainly a good one coming up. Former senior CIA analyst Ray McGovern will be on at the bottom of the hour. Now I see the switchboard's filling up already. I want to let you know. Here's the call-in number, 646-716-8652. It's a windy day out here. There's no wind coming this way. Not through Radio Free Kansas. This is going to get hard. It's going to get real. What would you do at the opportunity to talk to a man? A man who gave presidential briefs, daily briefs, to presidents, gathered information for 7 presidents, and worked under 9. That's right, 9. CIA director. Well, you get your chance here. Hour, call in, talk to Mr. McGovern. By the way, that's the Red Spot Finder by Alistair Hewlett. We'll take a jump on this and we'll open up the switchboard here. I got a caller. Do some visiting here before Mr. McGovern comes on. I will hog the phone line until the first 30 minutes or so with Mr. McGovern. But in the meantime, 267, you're on air. You got your hand up. You want to talk?
Hello, Mike.
Hey, Brian. Hey, how you doing? Listeners, this is Brian. You missed Wednesday Mysteries. Almost the first hour was dedicated to a conversation I had with Brian. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the whole deal going on in Europe and as it relates to America.
Sure.
Well, the big thing, of course, for many, many months was the issue as to what they were going to do with the Greeks and the Germans, and some of the economies in Europe that were healthier didn't want to bail out Greece. You know, their feeling was, well, you know, that's a Greek problem. They should deal with it. It's going to hurt our economy if we have to bail them out. And of course, the bureaucrats and Europe all got together and made sure they bailed out Greece to the tune of 700 billion euro, which is a trillion U.S., which is much, much more money than what they were originally told it was going to be. And, you know, it's now there's talk about a general bailout for the European currency. And it just seems like what they're doing in Europe is like what they've done here, which is just throwing a glass of water on a forest fire. And it just seems to be completely futile because you've got $646 trillion in derivatives, which is more than the entire worth of the world combined. You know, it's completely futile to do that.
What was that figure? 7. What trillion? How much?
Well, the worth of the derivatives bubble is $646 trillion, and the worth of the bailout for Greece was 700 billion euro, which is $1 trillion U.S.
Right.
But you know, I was going to say, yeah.
Well, I was talking with my sister wife this morning about this very issue, about the difference between the European economy and the economy in the United States and the use of bailouts. And, you know, she pointed out, I'm harping about the 53 cents of every federal tax dollar collected goes to the military. I immediately jumped into that. She pointed out, well, they're in debt, they're going broke, because there's this expanding bubble of entitlements. In Europe, there's a lot of entitlements, or what people, conservatives, call entitlements, which is health care, pensions, and Social Security and the like. These socialist measures, you know, guaranteed labor, guaranteed jobs, and stuff like that. And housing, controlled housing. Basically agreed that the problem was the central banks in both continents, Europe and the United States, America, were involved, deeply involved in brokering and profiteering off of these fictitious derivatives. I mean, these are like hallucinations. These are they're hallucinations, I think, even among the people that are selling them. These central banks in Europe were involved in highly speculative profiteering off of derivatives. Do we have any agreement on that, Brian?
100% agreement. And what greased the wheels for it is this: our fiat currency. You know, you have a fiat currency not backed by gold and silver. You have no restraining force on the growth of the monetary supply. So what some of the monetarists have argued over the years, and they do have a good point on this, is that fiat currencies and paper money never lasts more than 100 years. And if you don't have some kind of restraining force, which is either a gold and silver standard or banks, you know, having higher reserve requirements, there's nothing that can prevent rampant speculation. And that has always been a problem. And that's why Europe's in the same boat America is. Now, and Germany and France at one point might have been in better shape than other countries in Europe, but that's kind of like saying in America that Pennsylvania is in better shape than California, because they're ultimately all part of the same super state and they all have the same currency. And so they're all wrapped, they're all affected by this gigantic derivatives bubble. And it just tells it, all it does is it illustrates to me that the most important problem is the banking system. And the most important problem that needs to be addressed are these central banks. And if there's not a good solution to just addressing and dealing with these central banks, I don't see a way out of this crisis.
Well, I know the people in Greece are getting ready to be laid off and are angry. Probably would agree with you, but they probably wouldn't agree with this thing about fiat currency. I think that's sort of like, what would you do? Take it back to the people biting coins on the street, biting them to make sure that they're gold, you know, if there's a dent in it? I mean, how far back do we have to go in economics to, is it going to go back to the anti-greenback, you know, back in the 1880s, I believe, in Kansas? There was a huge movement against the greenbacks and I think that's too far. I think it was the derivatives. I think it was these instruments that were devised by an largely unregulated market of capitalism, finance capitalism in particular, that created this huge bubble. And there was a huge amount of fraud committed at the top about real estate in America. And I think that's part of it. I think there's an element of greed and fraud and wishful thinking involved in this. And I don't think it's just the gold standard, you know, or fiat. Can you call the derivative a form of fiat currency?
Oh no, but what I guess I'm trying to my argument is that the two are related. The derivatives bubble and the fiat currencies that all these countries have are related. My point is that without a restraining force, you can just print money indefinitely. And my point is that the fiat currencies are to the benefit of these speculators. I mean, after all, if you look at the Federal Reserve, through its creation at Jekyll Island in the early 1900s, it was created by the world's wealthiest financiers. And it was created, you know, with the idea to, you know, that you would just continue to churn out paper money for the benefit of bankers so they could continue to speculate. If you had some kind of restraining force, speculation would be impossible. Now, there are a couple options. You could return to some kind of a world monetary system like Bretton Woods, which President Nixon took us off in 71. You could for example, in the United States, issue money through the Treasury as stated in the Constitution and just raise reserve requirements for banks. That way you don't have to worry about Congress inflating the monetary supply. Or, yes, you could go to some kind of gold or silver, outright gold or silver standard. But my argument would be that any of those three solutions would be preferable to what we have now. Now, what would be the best solution? I tend to think just issuing money through the Treasury and raising reserve requirements. So in other words, it would limit the speculating that investment banks could do. Investment banks, if it were up to me, they would have 100% reserve requirements. So for every dollar they want to invest or speculate, they have to have a dollar set aside. And I believe that could be used to restrain speculative ventures. But I think that you have to start, the root of the problem is central banking. And there has to be some kind of restraining force. Maybe it's maybe going back to a gold or silver standards are archaic and not feasible. But then, at the very least, you have to have you still want to eliminate the central banks and have them raise reserve requirements. But there has to be some kind of restraint because the lack of restraint plays into the hands of these speculators. If you the lack of restraint makes it possible for them to create money out of thin air, and that's a big problem. But I would stress that the workings and policies of the central banks are for the benefit of these large investment banks, because they're the ones that have always controlled it, and they're the ones that create these central banks.
Yeah. Well, I agree with a lot of that. I do think that the finance capital is one of the big, nasty things that are happening in the world, and that have happened for quite a while. And I'm trying to get into with you. What do you think of your take on this latest? I mean, congressional effort to regulate Wall Street. I haven't read the law yet, but I note that the stock market collapsed 368 points, almost 3%. The day that I try to connect the dots, I know people say, "Don't do that. Don't." The market is so wildly speculative, going up and down. But it really makes me wonder. The newspapers say that it was because of fear that something to do with Greece and the European Union, but I can't. But on the same day was a reenactment of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was, listeners, a law that was abolished or repealed in I think the mid '90s with Clinton and the Republican Congress, dominated Congress, as a concession to. These same scoundrels that are doing this, they repealed that law, and that law was Glass-Steagall was originally implemented during the Great Depression as a manner of regulating banks, pinpointing banks and exactly what kind of business practices they were in, and auditing them The FDIC insurance came into play during that same period. These are regulations that were imposed. Do you think this new law, have you seen it?
Well, number one, it does not reinstitute Glass-Steagall. It doesn't even implement the so-called Volcker Rule, which is kind of like a watered-down, willy-nilly version of Glass-Steagall that really would have very little effect anyway. It's more farcical regulation, which actually gives the Federal Reserve more power and in the state of another economic crisis allows Congress, without a vote, to just shill out trillions of dollars to banks to prop them up. So it actually will benefit the largest investment banks. It does put some pressure onto, commercial banks and to people in real estate that are, predatory lenders. But that's not the real problem. The real problem are the hedge funds and investment banks and the Federal Reserve, pre-OPIC. And it does nothing to restrain their, power or abuse of power. And it's just more farcical regulation. It's like the health care bill, which people don't realize. The health insurance companies and drug companies lobbied for that health insurance bill to the tune of $120 million. And so this this financial regulatory package is just it's more shilling for Wall Street. It's another concession for Wall Street, and that's Obama's entire presidency has been one giant concession to Wall Street. Just like Bill Clinton's entire presidency was a concession to Wall Street. The only difference between now and 3 years ago is now we have a Democrat in office. It's really the only major difference. But all we have are people that can't wait to show for Wall Street. And Obama has a laundry list of people in his administration that are tied into Goldman Sachs.
Well, the first, and you agree, it's real. The first $700 billion went to Bush.
Oh yeah, well Bush. It was actually more than that, because it enabled the Federal Reserve to print much more money than that, and that was under Bush's presidency. And you'll notice during initially that did not pass the House of Representatives, and then McCain and Obama found it so important they left the campaign trail and buddied up with Bush and shilled for Bush in the banks to make sure it passed. And so these three people that were supposedly on competing sides, the so-called maverick, the so-called southern independent Texasman, and the so-called hope and change candidate, all shilled for the banks to pass that. But you're right, that started under Bush. That bank bailout passed under Bush. It was the Bush Paulson Bernanke bailout, and that was catastrophic.
And the resistance really did develop on the waning. Bush rammed it through in the waning days, and Congress rammed it through the waning days of the Bush administration. We've got just a few more minutes before senior CIA analyst Ray McGovern comes on. I'm sure you would consider this as much of a danger of national security as war, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'll keep you on. I have a couple announcements I need to make in the short time. Mr. McGovern, listeners, is due to come on in a few minutes, and I'll keep you online if you want to stay on and ask. It will be a little bit of a wait because Mr. McGovern and I are going to visit for a few minutes, but I'll keep you on, okay, Ryan?
Thanks a lot. I appreciate
thank
it.
You. Sure, thank you. And thanks for your commentary. I'm sorry. Well, listeners, I just put this in the mailbox. Fred Whitehead, Dr. Fred Whitehead, you may remember his name from the series of programs we did on the Appeal to Reason newspaper around May 1st, just a few weeks ago. And he has been doing an astounding series of DVDs of poets and lectures, slavery in Missouri, Missouri and slavery, poets Wally Wharton, Tom Page, they're local Kansas poets. And they're available for, I'm going to put up a catalog at the flyer and at the other blogs, the Scumfoot Magazine. I'll put up a circular so that you'll be able to order them, but and you'll get an idea of what they are. But you can order them for $5. This is a paltry fee, by the way. $5, as Fred, as Dr. Whitehead says, $5 to anywhere in the world. That's right, a DVD. Anywhere in the world. And here's how you can get it. It's P.O. Box 5224. And that's P.O. Box 5224. Kansas and Kansas, zip code 66118. I will be plugging that regularly. And I want you to get in contact with him. This is a great deal that I think you'll enjoy if you enjoy DVDs with poetry and stuff. And it's not boring stuff. He puts little slideshows in on them to entertain the eye while you're listening to the lectures. And I think you'll really enjoy it. Again, it's People's Culture, P.O. Box 5224, Kansas City, Kansas, zip code 66119. And I've been getting them, and thank you so much, Dr. Whitehead, for sending them in. I'm going to play a very short reading by Dr. Whitehead on some poetry, and hopefully we'll have Mr. Ray McGovern on here at the end of it. Here we go with Dr. Fred Whitehead reading about hidden history, people's culture. Folks, there's too many of us that have forgotten about this stuff, and I think this is way over time. Here's some poetry by Ed Stone.
Four poems by Ed Stone. Seeds. First, scorching to death all life on Earth so that they couldn't become contaminated, the three metallic messengers dispatched from outer space carried a luminous suitcase packed with sensitive equipment to test seeds that might inhabit the Earth's smoky crust. And immediately set to work in the dust, but found no living seed to test. Then the messengers split the Earth like a cantaloupe, and lightly they descended to the hollow center, where they found themselves wallowing in seeds, billions of bleeding, clicking seeds chanting, "We are the lost teeth of God." Written on a standard. Only some pleasures are admitted to the palaces of art. Commentary can be intricately conceived, but is averse to a wrought poem. A poet asterisk can never be the burning star of poetry. Ode to a Wounded Artist. The onslaught of icy dragons is relentless, but bind your wounds, you will survive. You will live and live to create those wonders that make the lovely covenant with thy neighbor's life, which is thy own. The Night I Saw Heaven. A devout old man asked me if I believed in God, and I said I sure would if I could see heaven. So the old man smiled, and his teeth were diamonds with rubies for fillings, and his tongue was like a ripe purple grape. So he gave me a pearl-handled telescope 7 yards long and an ice pick dipped in the blood of a lamb, and he told me to await the night of the full moon and to pluck out my right eye with a lamb-blooded ice pick and to look through the telescope with my empty eye socket, and I would see heaven. So came the night of the first full moon, and I plucked out my eye and gazed eyeless at the sky. I saw 7 stars drag racing and a picket line around Mars, and I saw the moon, and it was a white-hot womb in the black, swollen belly of the night. And I saw a busy old man milking 7,000 cows with one quick silvery hand and plowing 7 million acres of sweet, sweaty land with the other silvery hand. Then he drank 70 gallons of golden, glistening home brew, and he lay down on a haystack maybe 27 miles high, with 17 naked, maiden-headed maidens whose laughter banged the sky. So I called to the old man, "Are you in heaven?" And the old man sat up smiling, and his teeth were diamonds with rubies for fillings, and his tongue was like a ripe purple grape, and he shouted, "I sure am." This is Fred Whitehead signing in again for Radio Free Kansas. Today's short reflection is a piece that I wrote in 1981 called The Philosophy of the Working Class. A few years ago, Professor Yuri Melville of the University of Moscow was addressing an American academic audience on the basic questions of philosophy, and I still recall vividly one of his most pointed remarks. Why did graduate students in American philosophy department spend so much time pondering whether and if and how did imaginary beings, such as fairies or trolls and the like, exist? And so little time considering questions of philosophy and ethics which seem to confront us every day in our lives. Then, somewhat later, more light was thrown on this question by a response that Lenin made to a speaker at a medical congress before the revolution. The speaker was taking up the subject of abortion, claiming that it was a good thing not to bring children into the world because there was so much suffering and unhappiness. Lenin's response was characteristically incisive. "Here we have the basic difference between the psychology of the peasant, the artisan, and the intellectual of the petite bourgeoisie, generally, and the worker. The petite bourgeois feels that he is perishing, that life is becoming more difficult, the struggle for existence more intolerable, his situation and that of his family more and more hopeless. The class-conscious worker," Lenin continued, "is far removed from such a point of view. He will not allow his consciousness to be obscured by such views, no matter how sincerely and feelingly they may be uttered. We, workers and small owners, too, lead an unbearable life filled with oppression and suffering. In one respect, we are better off than our parents. We have learned, and are learning fast, to struggle. We are fighting better than our fathers did. Our children will fight still better, and they will win." One of the main tenets of working-class philosophy is an emphasis on life itself, the necessity for survival in spite of great odds, and a sense of joy and pride in striving toward happiness. There is a beautiful passage of Yevtushenko's great poem, Bratsk Station, about the construction of a huge hydroelectric dam in Siberia and a young worker named Nushka Bertova. After a difficult early life, she was orphaned by World War II, she becomes a concrete mixer on the construction project, falls in love with another worker who, however, deserts her after she becomes pregnant. Filled with anxiety, she has her baby, and as she is leaving the hospital, is greeted by a team of her workmates who have come to present her with flowers and to congratulate her. "They all helped me as if they were my savings, and from that time on, I was always asked by the men from the assembly unit or by the painter smilingly, 'Well, how is our little son?'" This innate sense of kindness and generosity seemed to me fundamental to workers' ethics, both under duress and capitalism and in the full flower of socialism. It is an expression of what the late communist poet Pablo Neruda called our duty to life. In our own American literary experience, there is a passage in a classic novel by Jack London, entitled Martin Eden, in which the hero is a writer who comes from poverty and near starvation, then makes the big time, only to realize that it is empty. One day he wanders into a park and toward a bricklayer's picnic, where he recognizes some old pals of his. He had been to the working-class picnics too often in his early life not to know what they were like, and as he entered the park he experienced a recrudescence of all the old sensations. After all, they were his kind, these working people. Martin drank with them, and he began to feel really human once more. He was a fool to have ever left them, he thought, and he was very certain that his sum of happiness would have been greater had he remained with them, and let alone the books and the people who sat in the high places. In the current bad times in the United States, which threaten soon to get much worse, we need to always remember our basic ethical principles, which will be as beacons in the darkness. It is obvious that few, if any, among the ruling class have such conceptions. And with the light of these principles, we can reveal them to be what they are.
Again, that's Dr. Fred Whitehead putting out an incredible series of historical pictures and DVDs and poetry available at People's Culture, P.O. Box 5224, Kansas City, Kansas 66119. As I said, I put up a catalog, the Fight Cock Fire and Discomfort magazine, describing the programs on DVD, and they're available for $5 anywhere in the world. I think we're approaching the time when Mr. Ray McGovern, former senior CIA analyst, will be on the show here, and I want to remind you, it's not every day you get a chance to listen in. The current subject of today's visit with Mr. McGovern is the shake-up, what I call a shake-up. No, it may not be that. At the White House, directed towards National Intelligence Gathering, the firing of Admiral Blair, who I believe is the Director of National Intelligence. Mr. McGovern has had the rare opportunity in life to serve under 7 presidents, 9 CIA directors, and I believe, now I'm not sure, but I think it was 2 presidents he gave the daily presidential briefs or was in charge of getting those daily briefs to those presidents. So it's an extremely privileged conversation you're about to listen into. I am going to hog, as they say out here, among my friends and neighbors. I'm going to hog the conversation with Mr. McGovern for the next 20 or 30 minutes. But you may call in, and I'll get you online. Area code 646-716-8652. Again, area code 646-716-8652. You know, I think the dark passions of empire are still well in play. As our first caller, Brian, intimated, when it came to the use of the central banks. However, the subject of the forte of Mr. McGovern is not economics. It is largely on the analysis of intelligence and the response of countries. There's been some great. By the way, the subject that we're going to be discussing today, is now at the top of the scroll at the flyer, as well at the famous, vitally important Consortium News, ran by editor-publisher Robert Perry. Consortium News, just Google, listeners. You know how to Google Consortium News. And at the top of his site, Mr. Perry's site, is the latest article. Oh, I lost my caller. Oh, goodness. And you're welcome to call back in. I do believe that was my guest. We'll see how it goes here. In the meantime, I'm sorry, we may have lost the switchboard here. I'll get back to you in a little bit. Here's hidden history. It's 2 minutes, and then I'll get back with you. Hidden history, 2 minutes. Jack Johnson's hidden history, and I'll be back with you in just a minute, I believe, with Mr. McGovern. Let me see here. Hidden history, the anniversary of the Jackson State Massacre.
Hi, I'm Jack R. Johnson, and this is Hidden Histories. If you Google Jackson State today, you have to work to even catch a glimpse of the violence that happened on their campus between May 14th and May 15th of 1970, just 10 short days after the Kent State Massacre. Perform that same Google search on Kent State, of course, and there is no doubt that something horrific happened. History has swallowed the incident at Jackson State University, Mississippi, but it's no less noteworthy than the massacre at Kent State some 40 years ago. On May 14th through 15th in 1970, Jackson State students were protesting the Kent State killings, as well as agitating for civil rights. A few students set several fires and overturned a dump truck that had been left on campus overnight at a sewer-lined construction site. Jackson firefighters dispatched to put out the blaze met a hostile crowd. Fearing for their safety, the firemen requested police backup. 75 policemen and Mississippi State police officers armed with carbine, submachine guns, shotguns, service revolvers, and some personal weapons responded to the call. After the firemen extinguished the blaze and left, the police and state troopers marched along the unfortunately named Lynch Street toward Alexander Center, a woman's residence, weapons at the ready. The officers deployed into a line facing the students. Someone in the crowd either threw or dropped a bottle, which shattered on the asphalt with a loud pop. That's when the police opened fire on the unarmed students. Over 200 rounds were discharged. Miraculously, only a dozen or so were wounded, but two students were killed. 21-year-old Philip Lafayette Gibbs, a Jackson State College student, and 17-year-old James Earl Green, a Jim Hill High School senior, were murdered on May 14, 1970, just 6 short days after the Kent State killings. It would be the second time in less than a week that U.S. authorities had murdered unarmed U.S. students. This is Jack R. Johnson for Hidden Histories.
Yes, and thank you for that 2 minutes of hidden history. By the way, folks, we're not in those times now. I think it's a totally different time now. And we're privileged and honored to have Ray McGovern, Mr. Ray McGovern, on. I believe I have him on air. Hello?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm here, Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Clear as a bell. Wonderful. Yes. Mr. McGovern, this is a disturbing article you just put up on that I guess Robert Perry put up. The headline, it's linked at the flyer, folks, or you can just go directly to Consortium News. Dirty Linen gets Intel chief fired. And it's also a lengthy article because you actually go into some of the personnel, I guess that's being lightly, putting it lightly, changes that are going on in the national intelligence community. And it ironically begins with the soiled underpants of Nigerian Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, a 23-year-old Nigerian, last Christmas. That's how it begins. And you say there's much dirty linen on the crowded clothesline of the intelligence community. And it was an easy way to get rid of Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair. An interesting opening paragraph there, by the way, Mr. McGovern.
Yeah, that was kind of part of the story. The if you can say Abdulmutallab, then you get to be Deputy National Security Advisor, by the way. That's how John Brennan earned his spurs. What we have here is a wonderful, one would say, golden opportunity to get rid of a guy who was becoming a real pain because he had these weird independent views on things. For example, when his substantive analyst told him that Iran had stopped working on the nuclear weapons-related part of its nuclear development program. In the fall of 2003, and that there was no evidence that they had resumed that work, he was unwilling to fudge that. He was unwilling to finesse that. And no matter how hard the Congress and others tried, and they tried very hard indeed, he stuck to that judgment. And that judgment is almost 3 years old. It was the one that prevented a war, frankly. Or at least it was a major factor in preventing a war with Iran. It came at the end of 2007, and some of your listeners probably remember that Dick Cheney has admitted now openly that he was pressing for war with Iran and was overruled in early 2008. How was he overruled? Well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, told Cheney's boss, you know, this is really crazy. This is really crazy because, you know, despite the immorality or the lawlessness of this, Iran, unlike Iraq, can retaliate in a way that will really, really hurt us, and a very large conflagration could ensue. So, to their great credit, Mullen and the fellow who was then head of CENTCOM, the Central Command, another admiral, by the way. Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard for me as an Army officer to give all this credit. But I have to say, you know, they're trained in such a way as to be certain, you know, independent. They got a ship, they're it, you know. So yeah. Fallon said, there's not going to be any war with Iran on my watch. And he got canned for that. But when this estimate came out, and we're talking about November 2007, which contradicted everything that Bush and Cheney had been saying about the imminent danger from Iran, well, that's what Mullen and Fallon used, because they got it publicized. They got it sanitized and made public, and the chance that the administration could still pretend that Iran was a danger, that it would have a nuclear weapon anytime soon, evaporated. So the reason I mention all this is that that was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
About 8 months ago, Admiral Blair, who was just canned, was asked to have his substantive analysts draw up another estimate. Now, the art form in the intelligence community is a memorandum to holders. Okay, that sounds mysterious, but all it means is...
I was fascinated with the title of that, Memorandum to Holders. I thought that was an interesting title, but could you explain what that is for us?
Sure, Mike. All it means is that you folks who hold, you privileged folks with the highest classification, the highest clearances, who already hold the bottom-up assessment published in November of 2007, we're going to make a memorandum for you holders of that previous estimate, which will be less ambitious and which will be aimed simply at updating that estimate, viewing the evidence over the last 3 years to see if there are any changes necessary. So that's a biggie, because that want to hit out at Iran would very much like Admiral Blair, the dearly departed Admiral Blair, and his successors to make Iran into the kind of threat that he showed himself unwilling to do. Now, this is in the best tradition of intelligence analysis. You know, people find it hard to believe, but we were created by President Truman primarily to speak truth. To gather all the facts, massage them, go through them, and come as close as we could to finding out what the truth was. Despite what the Pentagon might say or what the State Department might say, Truman wanted to be able to go to one person out there. We inhabited the woods in Virginia, about 9 miles outside of Washington. He would ask the director to come down and say, look, Mr. Director, I want to know what you and those two universities worth of of specialists out there in the woods of Virginia. I want to know what you really think about this issue. I think these Air Force folks are telling me they got these incredibly accurate bombers now. They're called B-52s, and they're going to close off the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they say we'll win the war because the North Vietnamese won't be able to supply the South. What do you guys think of that? Well, what we did, of course, was be sort of respectful and suppress a laugh. But we gave them a memo, a National Intelligence Estimate, within a couple of days to say, Mr. President, you need to realize that the Ho Chi Minh Trail doesn't look anything like the George Washington Memorial Parkway or I-66 or I-95. You can't even see portions of it from the air. And besides, it's about 150 trails. There's no way that bombing, however destructive by B-52s, to seal off that path. Now, that's just an example of the kind of work that presidents used to ask us to do. Now, the corollary of that, of course, is the president never had to heed our advice, and LBJ, for his own political reasons, decided, well, maybe these blue-suited guys that play these, that run these, maybe they're right, maybe the CIA is wrong. And so he would do the politically correct thing in hopes of never losing a war. Well, that's why these estimates are really important. And so Blair was very, he was an incompetent manager, let's face it. I mean, he never did the job that he was picked to do, and that was to knock heads together and get the intelligence community working together. We know that from the results of all these incidents. But he did do one thing, and that one thing was of equal importance, I would suggest. And that was that he respected the analysts. He didn't cook the intelligence, no matter how much pressure was upon him. And for that, he incurred the wrath of those who would like to zap Iran. In a word, they zapped him.
Well, I want to say, now that's why I wanted to put up, I thought it's not just a coy phrase, it's really in your essay, the latest at Consortium News, listeners, again, it's at the top of the scroll at Consortium News. The Zap or Iran crowd. There is a crowd out there, and they've been around for a long time. They're still around. Call them neocons. Call them whatever you want. But I thought that was a succinct phrase, the Zap Iran crowd. They're still operating in full-blown glory. And I'm going to ask you backtrack a little bit and help the layman out here. Who is Chaz Freeman? Because this is a symptom, I think, of, I think it foretold what was Blair's final reckoning. What was this thing with Mr. Freeman?
Well, Chaz Freeman is about the most respected, I think he's one of the smartest guys I ever ran into.
Mm-hmm.
He was a deputy secretary.
That's, by the way, something come from you, but go ahead. All right. I'm sorry.
To you, Mike. After you, I'd say. Yeah. Well, in all seriousness, this
yeah.
guy was one of the assistant secretaries of defense. During the first Gulf War, he was an ambassador to Saudi Arabia. It took him a couple months to learn Chinese. He interpreted for the first Nixon visit. The story is told that he sat there at the Foreign Service Institute learning Chinese, and when everybody else was still struggling to finish the exam, he would whip out a crossword puzzle and then work on that because he got bored. Anyhow, he enjoyed a very good reputation as being not only an incisive but a very well-balanced, very frank and candid diplomat. You can be both frank and candid and also a diplomat if you have guts. Now, what happened was Admiral Blair's first major decision on personnel came up when Tom Finger, now Tom Finger was the fellow who was responsible for doing the very honest estimate that said that Iran had stopped working on the nuclear weapons-related part of its program in the fall of 2003. Okay, so that was 4 years before that estimate, November of 2007. Now, Finger, having done his best for this country, and by the way, he came out of the State Department, not out of the intelligence agencies, he retired, well-deserved retirement. So here's Blair. He comes in a year and a half ago and says, oh, gosh, now I have to replace this gutsy guy who knew so much, and Finger was probably the third most intelligent guy I've run into in Washington. And so what I do? Well, he looked around, and he saw that Chas Freeman came incredibly highly recommended for his balanced views and all the other things I've already said, and so he named him director of the National Intelligence Council. Now, what's that? Well, that's the body that writes the president's daily brief. That's the body that writes the national intelligence estimates. There ain't nobody as important as this body in Washington, okay? So he appoints, as is his prerogative, of course, as director of national intelligence, he appoints Chas Freeman to be head of the National Intelligence Council. What happens? There's a furor. The Washington Post, which I consider a neoconservative paper, favoring mostly the interests of Israel, started waging an open fight. And what finally happened, and this is the first time I've ever seen this happen in Washington, you know, usually you have fights about the deputy secretaries or secretaries of the Treasury or whatever. This was down in, well, not really the weeds, because it was a very responsible job, but no congressperson has ever interfered in the appointment of a second-tier intelligence official, and I can speak out of 40 years' experience in that. Well, what happened was Blair picked Chas Freeman to be the head of his National Intelligence Council, and on the morning of March 10th, Chas Freeman was having breakfast with David Broder of the Washington Post, and David said, "Are you expecting any opposition?" And Chas, "Oh yeah, there'll be a lot of opposition, especially from the neocons, because I don't see that Israel is always right on these things, and I'm going to say that. But I think, you know, I think it'll be overcome." And then Blair announced that Freeman will bring to the job his long experience and inventive mind, et cetera. And what happened was Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, and Joe Lieberman, the senator from Connecticut, who are, you know, the arch neoconservatives, always interested in making sure that whoever is running studies or whatever is sort of favors Israel. Well, they descended upon Rahm Emanuel, you know, who also is a dual citizen, and said, "Hey, this cannot be." And so by 5 o'clock, Blair had to tell Freeman, the White House says, no, Rahm Emanuel won't let you become the director of the National Intelligence Council. And so Freeman made this statement that he had asked Admiral Blair that his selection, quote, not proceed. Now, the interesting thing about Freeman, I told you he was candid and frank before.
Right.
But he went down swinging. He criticized the withdrawal of his previous acceptance. You know, he was appointed. It wasn't like he was being considered for appointment. He was appointed in his job, and he was out of the day. And he criticized what he called the Israel lobby. And this is a quote from what Freeman said in a formal statement. "The aim of the Israel lobby is to control the policy process through an exercise of a veto over the appointment of people who dispute the wisdom of its views. They want to exclude any and all options for decision by Americans and our government other than those that the lobby favors." Now, that's a biggie. That is really big. The fact that the lobby was able to prevent a wonderfully qualified, astute, and gutsy guy to follow in the tradition of the fellow Tom Finger, who had done that gutsy memorandum on Iran nuclear, the fact that Admiral Blair was denied the ability to appoint his own person there, And the fact that he knocked a whole bunch of noses out of joint and got people really militating against him as early as then, well, that did him in. It wasn't just the underwear bomber. It wasn't just all these other terrorist things. It was the lobby. And, you know, if further proof were needed, Mike, this is really interesting. I'm reading from the Washington Post. As I say, it's run by neoconservatives. Their editorial page, at least, is. And here's the editorial, lead editorial from the Washington Post today. It says that the resignation of Blair as director of national intelligence, quote, was the product of personal as well as institutional failings. What was his personal failing? Well, it says, quote, his judgment looked questionable from the beginning when he nominated a former ambassador with crackpot views about the Israel lobby.
Oh, my God, that's scary. They're scaring Blair on the way down, you say.
Yeah, so here's, you know, they're kicking him on the way down, and this is their way of saying, we got you, man. Don't serve notice to everybody in Washington. You do something like nominate or appoint, in this case, a person who looks with equal justice to both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. He's gonna go down in flames, and just try it if you don't believe me. So here's the Post gloating over his demise, and I was just happy to see this confirmation of what I had written yesterday, namely that this played a big role in the fact that people were out to get Blair. It wasn't only the underwear pants bomber, it was this, and it was also his refusal to back off the judgments on Iran. Now, the problem, Mike, or the concern I have, is that with Blair gone, you've got a bunch of second string, I would say. I don't know these people very well, but, you know, they're non-entities. They have no, what the Germans call, formats, you know. They have no real stature, no gravitas, I guess is another way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they won't, you know, they never wore four stars like Admiral Blair did. So they're going to have a lot of trouble facing down these neoconservatives, facing down the Israel lobby that wants to make Iran out to be a major threat. And so I fear for how this new memorandum to holders, this new mini estimate, because if it comes out saying dishonest things, like Iran is hell-bent on acquiring a nuclear weapon, which is what Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said 2 years ago, no proof of that. If it says that anyway, we're in trouble. We're in deep trouble. That means the president has ceded his ability to decide these things to the lobby, and there's an equal chance, in my view, that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu will figure he has carte blanche to zap Iran. If he sends his fighter bombers through Iraqi airspace, still control that airspace, which will be up to this summer, do you think he thinks that our president's going to have the guts to shoot him down?
Boy.
No way will Barack Obama shoot him down. And so, you know, if you're Netanyahu and you have this opinion of the American president as a kind of a wuss, you know, he says, no more settlements, no more settlements. And then a few days later, hey, there's going to be more settlements, there's going to be more settlements. And Barack Obama didn't do anything. And if he doesn't, you know, he sends all these people to me, like Admiral Mullen, and he says, please, please don't attack Iran. That would be a bad idea. But he never comes out publicly and says, I have told the Israeli Prime Minister not to get us involved in a war with Iran. He never says that, so he must be, I don't know, he must be either a wuss or he's so beholden to the Israel lobby that he's unwilling to do that. So if I were Netanyahu, and I thought that you know, the time's evaporating for me to be able to make some trouble, to stir up some grief there for Iran, and maybe even attack them, with the relative surety that Obama would be forced by political circumstances in this country to back him and actually to enter the war on Israel's side, Well, I'd try it if I were Netanyahu and I had that assessment, and that would be, well, I can't, would make the war in Iraq look like a volleyball game between Mount St. Ursula and St. Catherine's Academy.
Well, it could, it could very well. I agree with you 100%. I think some of our best generals have said that too. Once the war begins, you never know where it's going to go, and it's very predictable with the Gulf of Hormuz and the Straits of Hormuz, excuse me, and what could very well, it could escalate, and I think Admiral Fallon called it a conflagration, I think was the word he used, could turn into a global economic catastrophe as well. It's an amazing thing that they've eked their way inch by inch after the ouster of the Bush administration, that Obama he's almost like eliminating, subjectively, I'm saying, eliminating opposition. And it might be both. He's a wuss and he is beholden to them, to the Israeli lobby, to such an extent that he would just let the Israeli government do this type of shenanigans. Listeners, I want to remind you that there was an interesting thing on the left, for the non-existent, very minuscule left in this country. Professor Noam Chomsky was denied entry into Israel, and he himself is I think he's probably would consider himself a secular Jew, if anything, at least that's his ancestral heritage as a secular Jew, and it turned into a hoopla about him coming into Gaza, I believe, and the Israeli.
There was the West Bank, Mike.
The West Bank.
West Bank. He was coming in from Jordan.
And they stopped him. And it turned into a media hoopla, what I call it, because the unique thing was here you're seeing the Israeli government spokespeople saying, well, there's probably a mistake or something, he wasn't going to speak at an Israeli university, but we didn't want to let him into the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't help but feel like they're playing games with us here, Americans here in our country. But they're doing it in such a mercurial way. And there was something I don't think many people – you mentioned it again, folks, that's at the top of the scroll today and today only, Consortium News, Bob Perry's fantastic Consortium News, Mr. McGovern's latest. And you mentioned in that – that there were hundreds of intelligence analysts. Now, listeners, I'm going to play this as a layman. Experience with Mr. McGovern, he's patiently laid out for me several times. There's a huge gulf between analysts, the analytical sector of central intelligence, and the what I would call the spooks and the people that do all those dirty things that we've read about. I guess you say hundreds of analysts left in the months after or before, right after 9/11. This was that's something I didn't really realize. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, this was actually started before 9/11. It was when this General Clapper reminded of that old song, "Gentlemen Dapper stepped out of the." Yeah, okay. Anyhow, General Clapper. And these are the words that he said. Our mother never told her the thing. You remember that one? Anyhow,
two Irishmen talking right now, but that's I agree. Clapper, what a name! Hell of a name. But I mean, what was he doing?
So, Lieutenant General Air Force James Clapper stepped out of the crapper, and these are the words that he said.
Right.
Rearranged the deck there on the Titanic that was then the Defense Agency. Now, this was not CIA. He was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is kind of schizophrenic since it reports to people like Rumsfeld, in this case Gates, but it also to be, supposed to report to the head of national intelligence, which was, of course, Admiral Blair until just yesterday. So anyhow, he headed up this thing, and he had no respect for what was going on there. He dissed the senior analyst, Pat Lang, who was actually the Defense Intelligence Officer for the Middle East, was around, and he told me yesterday, and I include this comment, that Clapper was well known for being just a total bundle of ambition, that the man walked including ambition, and other people that I know real well and who are members of our movement, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, have told me that the DIA people at that time, and we're talking 91 to 95, considered Clapper the worst DIA chief in their experience, and that's saying something.
Uh-huh.
The thing that caught my attention is something that I kind of knew vaguely, but I looked up, Googled it yesterday. Sure enough, Clapper was head of something called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency.
I was wondering, I've never heard of that one, Mr. McGovern. What is geospatial what? What is that thing?
Good question. You know, it sounds funny, but it's really, really important. Let me explain why. We get a lot of our intelligence from satellites, from aerial photography, from all manner of sensors, not only optical imagery, but all manner of other things. It's highly sophisticated, and the Air Force pretty much runs the collection of these things, okay? But when it comes down to Earth, it has always been the job of the Central Intelligence Agency as a civilian, non-departmental, objective evaluator to evaluate this stuff. And so up until 1996, we had a coterie of maybe 200 well-experienced imagery analysts. Some of them were still around from September and October of 1962, when they caught the missiles going into Cuba from the Soviet Union. They knew their business really well. Okay, guess what happens in 1996? A very ambitious, you know, in Washington here, ambition is really the bane of our existence. A very ambitious fellow named John Deutsch, who was sort of, how would we say, he was lusting after the position of Secretary of Defense. He was pretty much promised that by his best buddy, who was then Secretary of Defense. And so Clinton said, well, you can't be that yet. Why don't you become Director of Central Intelligence, run the CIA? And Deutsch said, okay, well, I could do that for a year or so, but then I want to take Bill Perry's place as Secretary of Defense. And Clinton said, well, okay, let's see. Well, in the event, Clinton picked Dave Cohen, to be the new Secretary of Defense. And, of course, before that happened, Deutsch made all kinds of decisions to ingratiate himself. What Deutsch did, to his credit, was take the National Photographic Interpretation Center, which is what this unit of 200 imagery analysts was called. He took that whole center and he gave it away to the Pentagon. No longer have the independent, non-departmental way of assessing, of analyzing imagery once it's down from the satellites. It all belongs to who? Or Rumsfeld, or Robert Gates. Now, what does that mean? That means that when General Clapper came on the scene in 1991 and took over the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, that was 2001, I'm sorry, 2001 is when he took it over, okay? Then we had 9/11, and then, of course, we had the felt need on the part of Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Cheney, and fellow who's president, and Bush, to manufacture evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, how do we learn about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Well, the only way you can really do that is satellite photography or deceptive messages, okay? So guess what? Clapper takes over, and just think of what that means. You don't have any objective analysts now. You have sergeants and majors and lieutenant colonels who are looking at all these reports of dire buildings that are preparing biological, chemical, and nuclear warfare. And you're looking at them, and you go, oh, no, that's a chicken coop. Oh, no, that now we know they're building cars there. No, we know this over here is an agricultural machinery. And so you're not finding any weapons of mass destruction. Now, it's going to take a very gutsy specialist or major or even general to go to Don Rumsfeld and say, Mr. Secretary, I'm sorry, but all those great sources that you get from Israel and other places, they don't know what they're talking about because we've looked at all these coordinates and there ain't no weapons of mass destruction. So you come off it, man. You're badly misguided if you think there's evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Now, Clapper is one of these saluters, right? He salutes smartly. And he adopted what I call the Rumsfeld dictum. He must have learned that at Princeton. He was a real smart guy. And it's this quote, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, period, end quote. So, the fact that you don't have any evidence in all of the satellite photography that we have every day, twice a day from Iraq, that doesn't mean they're not there, man. Don't tell me they're not there. And so Clapper didn't let anybody tell anybody that they weren't there. Now, that's the guy. The reason Clapper is coming out of the grapper here is simply that he's the guy that's brooded about as being the most likely successor to Admiral Blair as the Director of National Intelligence. And if that happens, I want to tell you, Iran will automatically be a major threat, and all kinds of other chicanery is going to happen to the intelligence because Clapper, as my friend Colonel Pat Lang said, is just one extraordinary human bundle of ambition.
It does seem that the Zap Iran crowd has a leg up again, and that's what's disturbing. You talked about this earlier in a previous article, which is still available at Consortium News, and this is an amazing, I don't know what you'd call it, thumbing of the nose by the developing countries. I don't know what you'd call this, but Turkey and, well, I watched it. Thoughtfully, listeners, you go to that article. I'm looking for it right now on the web. The actual title of it at Consortium News, and there's a hilarious BBC link that Mr. McGovern embedded in his piece, and it's just I watched it and I was rolling because many people don't realize that Brazil, of all places, and Turkey, at a really, I guess it was an international conference. And they just absolutely snubbed the foreign minister or prime minister of Turkey, and it was caught on tape on video on BBC, and it's linked at the headline at Consortium News, U.S. Israel challenged on Iran. Could you give us a little background, because this is just a few weeks ago? I think the conference was a while back, but they're being snubbed by what I call the developing world. It was an interesting snub. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we started that article out by saying the times are a changing, and that's the good news. Here's the background. Gaza. That fierce, unconscionable attack on Gazan civilians from the 27th of December 2008 until the end of January of the following year, 2009, where 1,400 Gazan civilians were killed and 14 Israelis. The Israelis just had no care for how that would come across. It came across as a very brutal attack. Now, Turkey has traditionally enjoyed a pretty warm relationship with Israel, but, you know, every now and then you get a prime minister with courage, a prime minister that doesn't want to abide this kind of oppression of the people in the biggest open-air concentration camp in the world. And so Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, he's sitting there in Davos, in Switzerland, where they have these big economic summit meetings, and he's sitting next to Shimon Peres, the president of Israel, and on his right-hand side is David Ignatius. Now, David Ignatius is what I would call another neoconservative. Let me just spell that out. A neoconservative, in my view, is a person usually of Jewish extraction who has great difficulty distinguishing between what he believes to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of the United States of America on the other. That's the way I would describe it, and don't blanch before that notion, because that's what's running policy in Washington. Anyhow, David Ignatius is supposed to be moderating this little session, and you've got Peres from Israel, and you've got Erdogan from Turkey, and then you have the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, right next. Anyhow, what Ignatius makes the mistake of doing is giving Shimon Peres from Israel 24 minutes to speak, during which Shimon Peres defends what's going on in Gaza. It's just a week after they stopped this attack on Gaza. And then he gives Erdogan just 12 minutes. So, you know, by math is right, that's about half as much time, right? So after Peres is finished, Erdogan is in high dudgeon, you know, and he says to Ignatius, you know, this is outrageous. I'm going to have to reply to that. And Ignatius says, no, we have to let these people go to dinner.
Go to dinner.
So here's the premier of Turkey batting away Ignatius's arm, you know. Ignatius got his hand on his shoulder. He backs it away and he says, no, I'm going to respond to this. And you know what Erdogan says, this devout Muslim? He says, you know, there's a sixth commandment. It says, thou shalt not kill. And that's what's going on here, killing. And it's defended by this fellow on my left. And then Ignatius says, no, we have to go now. Let's restart the dial, you know. And Erdogan backs his hand away, too. And he says, no, we have to listen to this because that's what's going on now. And the violence there is out of all proportion to what is necessary. And I have to say that. And you gave him 24 minutes, you give me 12 minutes, I don't think that's fair, and so I'm getting out of here, and I don't think I'll ever come back to Davos, thank you very much, and he gets up and he walks out. So, and Ignatius is like, oh, but Mr. Prime Minister, and Erdogan walks out. Now, you know, Erdogan is a pretty theatrical guy, so you have to take a little bit of this with a grain of salt, but, you know, he comes, maybe you agree, Mike, he comes through as being really just outraged.
It was hilarious because he was, I don't think it was that theatrical, actually. I was, I could share the guy's grief with Ignatius because, I mean, that guy is, I mean, I've read some of his stuff. I think he's a columnist for the Washington Post, at least I think so.
And got it.
I've seen him on television here, out here in Kansas. He's the expert, blah, blah, blah. And when I watched him sort of, this guy from Turkey sort of raised his arm up and said, no, you know, and I was like, now that's, I don't think it's theatrics. I think it was a real statement. And now what was this development with Brazil? What's going on? What is this? There's something going on here, I think.
It's good you asked that because just 5 days later,
Brazil took the initiative of issuing a very strong condemnation of what Israel had done in Gaza.
Uh-huh.
And then as Brazil and Turkey, who are both members, you know, temporary members of the UN Security Council, had to listen to all this synthetic outrage at what Iran is doing, both countries took more and more interest in what was the real case here. And they went to Iran and they talked to the Iranians and said, what's going on here, you know? And to make a long story short, although they were told explicitly by Secretary Hillary Clinton and by letter from President Barack Obama, not to mess around with the Iranians here, and certainly not to try to do something that would derail our plan for sanctions against Iran. Despite that, they went to Iran and they concluded a deal which provides for half low-enriched uranium has to be given to Turkey to be sent out of the country. What does that mean? That means that they can't use the half of the uranium that they have to refine it to a higher degree and make a bomb out of it. It's big. This is as big as it gets, okay? So they arranged with Iran to declare their readiness to do that. Turkey will take it, and they'll give it out to people who can reprocess it to the degree necessary to run their nuclear medical establishment, you know, the one that does the CAT scans and the PET scans and all that kind of stuff, and they'll give it back in a year. So for a whole year, Iran has decided to give half of its uranium out of the country. Now, you would think, maybe your listeners would agree, you would think that we would think that's a good thing, and that the Israelis would think that's a good thing, you know? But guess what? It ain't about Iran nuclear. If it were, the Israelis and the U.S. would be saying, hey, this is great news. You know, half of the uranium they can't use now. But they're not saying that. And you know why? Because it ain't about fears of nukes from Iran. It's about regime change. Now, mm-hmm. listeners who don't know what that means, we used to call it overthrowing regimes. As a matter of fact, we did that. We did that in Tehran, as a matter of fact, in 1953. Why? Because BP wanted to run the oil there, okay? BP, remember BP? Yeah, okay. So regime change is the name of the game. And if regime change is what they want, then it doesn't really serve Israel's or the neocons' purpose to rehabilitate Ahmadinejad or the mullahs into thinking they're respectable people, they're not a threat, and that they're willing to deal. No, that can't be. And so instead of our welcoming that move and saying, well, thanks, Brazil and Turkey, if you can make this thing work, that will give us all breathing space to work out a permanent agreement with Tehran. Instead of that, what does Hillary Clinton do? She gets up the next day before the United Nations and says, oh, we've agreed now, the big five, the five permanent members, to have a sanctions regime against Iran because of their violation of UN security resolutions. And this is our response. She said this. This is our response to that Brazilian-Turkish initiative. Well, wow, how transparent is that, you know? How transparent is that? You know, it's very clear for anybody who looks at the thing. You know, logically, if we're so upset, and if Israel says that they regard the fact that Iran can process uranium, if they're interpreting that as what they call a, quote, existential threat, end quote,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you think, Mike, that if Iran promised to send half of what it's got out to Turkey, wouldn't you think that would be a good thing? Well, of course, any sensible person would, except, again, I'll say it ain't about the nuclear thing. It's about regime change. And my fear is that if people like Hillary Clinton and the Israel lobby continue to dictate our policy, it's very, very likely Well, very, very likely, but there's a good possibility that Netanyahu will misread this and say, well, or maybe not misread it, maybe read it appropriately.
Right.
Say, well, now's the time to send my fighter bombers and rockets through Iraq before the Americans give the airspace over to the Iraqis. And, you know, if we do that and start this thing, it ain't no way that Barack Obama can avoid becoming involved fully in defense of, quote, our ally, end quote, Israel. And just a final note on that for those of your listeners who haven't heard me say this, it is not accurate to call Israel our ally. If you look up the...
Why is that? Because I know many, many people out here, well, forgive me, many, let's begin, start at the very beginning, the start at the top of the list, Senator Sam Brownback, Senator Pat Roberts, General Richard Myers, and many of the people out here who vote for the senators, who Mr. Brownback's going to be they're coordinating him right now as the future governor of Kansas. Very little opposition, and many people do consider the Israeli government an ally. Why would you dispute that, Mr. McGovern?
Well, there's a juridical definition of ally.
Mm-hmm.
And what an ally is a country with which your country has a mutual defense treaty. There is no mutual defense treaty between the United States of America and Israel, and there's a reason for that.
I want to hold you up for just a minute, Mr. McGovern.
Sure.
A mutual defense treaty means that if they're attacked, we will attack their enemy. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. When I was born there in 39, when Britain had a mutual defense treaty with Poland, and when Hitler invaded Poland, Britain was automatically in the war on Poland's side. So it's an automatic thing, and it's more than just a fine point here. And let me explain why. After the two wars in the Middle East, 67 and 73, we thought that, you know, maybe we could offer Israel the kind of guarantee that would let it be a little bit more relaxed into thinking that, you know, if the Arabs were going to attack Israel, they would have the United States to contend with, okay? And so, formally, but very, very strongly, we broached the notion to the Israelis. We said, look, would you like to have a mutual defense treaty with us? And guess what they said? Well, that's really nice of you to suggest that. Thanks, but no thanks. Now, why did they say that, Mike? Two reasons. Number one, a mutual defense treaty needs to have clearly delineated, internationally recognized borders around both countries. Now, Israel is not about to leave the occupied territories. And so it would be impossible to do a treaty with Israel unless Israel was going to go back into its internationally recognized borders. That was a biggie. That was number one. Number two is that when you have a real ally, a person that you're obliged to defend, well, then if you're going to start a war with another country, you know, it's not only common courtesy, but these treaties provide the necessity that you would at least inform the other country before you do this, and the Israelis weren't about to limit their... If they want to attack Lebanon, they don't want to come to Washington. Oh, by the way, we're going to attack Lebanon next week, or Gaza, or Syria, or anything like that.
Right.
So there were two, in Israel's mind, there were two very good reasons why, hey, who needs a treaty with the United States when everybody calls us an ally anyway, including the President of the United States?
Yeah.
You know, there's the old saw, you know, and this is, my wife keeps telling me you have to warn people ahead of time that you're telling a joke of sorts, okay? So this is somebody said...
Ireland, maybe. Not in Ireland, but go ahead.
Somebody said that they had offered Israel statehood. You know, that they said, well, why don't you from the 51st state of the United States of America. And they turned it down abruptly. And they said, well, that would mean we'd only have two senators.
Mr. McGovern, will you take a phone call?
Sure.
Well, now, callers, some of you have been on, up and on the switchboard. I watch you call in and then hang up. Well, Mr. McGovern can stay on for a few more minutes. You get one, but keep your questions pertinent to the subject at hand. And I think, thank you, I believe this is Brian from Pennsylvania, and Brian's one of my more intelligent listeners, and I'm putting him right in the corner. Brian, are you there? Can you hear me?
I'm here, and Mike, I'm also Irish, too, so you got a third Irishman today.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, between us three, and I'll see what happens to the switchboard, a bunch of them dropped off. But
and you can ask a long question, then.
Yeah, right. Here's the code, 646-716-8652, if you'd like to call in the remaining minutes, at 646-716-8652, listeners. And Brian, go on with your question. Go ahead.
Well, one of the questions I've really been wanting to ask Ray is, do you ever, think that maybe people like Ron Paul who call for a non-interventionist foreign policy, that, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea?
Well, I think Ron Paul's right on foreign policy. I think he makes an awful lot of sense. I have to say that I disagree with him strongly on domestic policy. It's kind of too bad that I couldn't persuade him of my views on domestic policy. But on foreign policy, he's golden.
I mean, I just kind of get the sense that, maybe we ought to stay out of the affairs of other nations. It just seems like we cause, more problems than we solve. Even dating back to, I know you gave your definition of neoconservatives, but if you even look back to Woodrow Wilson and the liberal internationalist or the Rockefeller Republicans who kicked out the Taft wing of the Republican Party, I mean, I can't remember the last time an intervention of ours actually worked to our benefit. I mean, would you agree with that or disagree?
Yeah, I think the time has passed when any of that stuff is going to work, and the sooner we recognize that, the better. This idea of empire, empires always fall. And this initiative by Brazil and Turkey, and I think Mike was right in saying it pretty much amounted to Brazil and Turkey both thumbing their nose at the United States, that's new. And that shows that things have changed, even in the Middle East, in the sense that the U.S. and Israel can no longer completely dominate the way issues are handled in that part of the world. So the empire is being frittered away. The question is whether it'll be smart enough to let it fall gradually, or whether it's going to take some sort of cataclysm. And were we to become involved in a war with Iran, that, in my definition, that would be a cataclysm.
Do you believe that Obama's a neoconservative?
I don't know what Obama is anymore. And give me another year, maybe I'll be able to figure it out.
You work for 7 different presidents. I mean, are there any presidents that you work for that you feel that either were not neoconservatives or really offered something different?
Oh, sure. If you go into history, the first president I worked for was President Kennedy. If he hadn't been killed, the world would be very different today, I'm convinced. President Carter put a premium on human rights, a whole different approach, not a empire-type approach, but he was ridiculed for that. And, of course, the hostage-taking in Iran pretty much did him in. So there have been folks that have had good instincts, have tried to do the right thing, but either they get killed or they get marginalized or they get tricked out of an election, and that's kind of a sorry history in my view for the last couple of presidencies.
And you gave presidential briefings to 2 different presidents or intelligence briefings. What were your experiences with those 2 presidents, good or bad?
I'd tell you this, Brian, but then I have to shoot you.
I put 2 presidents on there only because Mr. McGovern confided in me.
The deal here is kind of interesting because during Nixon and Ford, we used to prepare the President's Daily Brief, and I was on that staff then and served in that capacity. In those days, we would take great pains to do an incredibly good production 6 days a week, but then we would send it off down to the White House for
Henry Kissinger
or someone like that to kind of look at and vet and take apart and give to the presidents. In other words, truth be told, well, we prepared this excellent document every morning, 6 days a week. We were never sure that the president read it. It could have been sabotaged. It could have been, you know, Henry Kissinger knew all the answers. So why does he need the CIA? So that was during the first two presidents for which I wrote the President's Daily Brief. Now, what happened with President Reagan was really... it was really an interesting story. Do we have about 3 minutes left, Mike?
Oh,
can
yeah,
I tell
sure.
This?
You tell,
okay.
I want listeners to hear this. This is a.
Yeah. Well, what happened? What happened was this.
This is your
it was really interesting.
It's a bonafide.
When Reagan won the election, we went to Stansfield Turner, admiral who was the director at the time. And we said, you know, in all fairness, since Reagan really needs to, you know, as much information on foreign policy as possible, we think that we should give the President's Daily Brief to Reagan, even though he's not president yet. And Turner said, well, let me check with Jimmy Carter. He did. He said, sure. Carter says, go. Now, those were all the instructions we had, okay? So two of my colleagues went out to the West Coast where we had a facility which would be able to receive very sensitive documents. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, they picked up the President's Daily Brief, and they went up to the Pacific Palisades where Reagan's house was, and they showed their IDs to the Secret Service, and we're here for the morning briefing. Morning briefing. Wow, the CIA morning briefing, the President's Daily Brief. I said, well, we don't know anything about this. Go away. And just then, President-elect Reagan comes down the stairs in his bathrobe. He said, what's going on here? And we explained, we're the CIA. We want to give you the morning briefing. Oh, come on in. Well, my two friends had breakfast with President-elect Reagan. He loved the service we provided. We had one or two of those senior people out there at all times. And by the time he came back into Washington, he was hooked on this daily treatment. And so when he took office, the vice president, whose name was H.W. Bush, went to Reagan and said, now, I think that not only you, but, you know, the rest of us, some of us, maybe a handful, should get the same treatment. What do you think? And Reagan says, well, who are you thinking about? And George Bush said, well, me. and Secretary Schultz, or Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and oh, your national security assistant, those should get it for sure. And Reagan says, oh, good idea, George, let's do that. And then Bush said, well, what time do you want to be briefed? And Reagan said, well, you know, I think now that I'm president, I think probably I'd like to sleep in. So what if the CIA brief all you guys, and then about 11 o'clock, maybe you could come brief me and tell me what they told you. And so, truth be told, my beat was usually the Secretary of State and the Vice President. We had two teams going all the time. But we very seldom saw Reagan. But we did see his immediate advisors, all of whom knew that the others were getting this personal service. I mean, this is one-on-one stuff, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And so we had unique access, you know, unheard of access to the White House for the entire period of Reagan's administrations and Bush's as well, and it's still down there until today. So that's how we got insinuated into the situation, and that's how we could, and I could personally, tell Secretary Schultz, for example, that, you know, this Gorbachev fellow there that's in power in the Soviet Union, we've been looking at what he's been saying, what he's been allowing to get into Pravda. We think he's the real deal. We think you can deal with him. And, you know, that was big because to have
Hold on here. Because that guy was Mr. McGovern.
Yeah. Can you hear me still?
Yes. I think that might have been Brian's phone. Go ahead.
Schultz, you know, was really determined to see if what he was being told by CIA Director Casey and his protege, a fellow named Robert Gates, who's not a secretary, they were telling the president that the Soviet Union will never change. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union would never leave power, and you know, Gorbachev is just a big trickster, and Schultz, to his credit, saw it differently, and was able to pursue a different path. And so, you know, it was nice to be able to meet with these people one on one, and tell them what I and the Soviet specialists that I knew quite well, having been one myself, what they really thought, not what Casey was letting them to say. And so that was real heavy-duty stuff. It was the best job I ever had. And I did it for years, and it was the end of the era when we really could tell the president what we thought. And that's why, you know, when George Tenet, the director that served under the more recent President Bush, when he decided to corrupt the intelligence to justify an unjustifiable war with Iraq, well, you know, that's as bad as it gets. And that's why several of my friends, we banded together in this Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity movement and have been publishing since before the war in Iraq, trying to get the truth out so that people can understand what's really going on, because, sad to say, they can't get it from what I call the fawning corporate media.
That's right. Mel Goodman, I think, is one of those VIPs, isn't he?
Yeah, well, Mel and I worked together in the same branch with Robert Gates. We were all working on Soviet foreign policy at the time, and Mel was just a tad smarter than Robert Gates. But he didn't sniff the prevailing winds from the White House as well as Gates did. And so Mel, to his great credit, you know, he was a senior intelligence service person. He quit. And when he was no longer able to tell the truth, he quit. And he took a job at a lower grade and ended up being head of a department at the National Defense University and still able to look at himself in the mirror when he shaved in the morning. I wonder how Robert Gates handles that, actually.
Last question, Brian, if you're still on.
Yeah, one more question, and I only ask this because you had mentioned Vietnam earlier, and one of the arguments of Vietnam, and I'd like to hear your take on this, has always been that, well, we lost the war, and the war is a disaster, but if we had bombed their supply lines at Haiphong Harbor and mined their ports, that perhaps the war could have ended differently and we could have won. How would you answer that question?
I would say what the British say in such circumstances, rubbish. We did that. We mined Haiphong. We bombed the heck out of Hanoi and Haiphong. There was no way we could win that war. No way. You know.
So it had nothing to do with rules of engagement, in other words.
Well, not unless we were going to drop some nukes on them and destroy not only 3 million Vietnamese, but all 20 million of them. I mean, it was so clear, and it was clear to us, and we warned the president about this. If you go back to 1945, the way Ho Chi Minh got back into Hanoi after his forces drove the Japanese out was on the shoulders of OSS people who ended up working next to me in the CIA as analysts of Indochina, okay? So Ho Chi Minh, he was a revolutionary, and he was a nationalist, and he also happened to be a communist. Now, the notion that he would let himself be used by his archenemy, the Chinese, or by the Soviets, who had sold him down the river at the Geneva Conference in 1954, the notion that Ho Chi Minh was going to be manipulated by these people to spread communism throughout Southeast Asia, including Indonesia and all this other stuff about the dominoes, that was ridiculous on its face. The last thing I'll say is that after 1945, the French were wondering whether they could get back their empire in Indochina, okay? And so they sent down a war hero, General Leclerc, okay, big war hero from World War II, okay? And they said, General, report to us as to how many people it would take to get back to Indochina, okay? Now, Leclerc spent a half year out there, and he wired back, and he said, Monsieur General, it would take 500,000 troops, and even then, we couldn't do it. Okay? Now, that's 1946. Now, what happens? 1968, the United States of America has 536,000 troops there, and we couldn't do it. Now, what makes us think that we can go into a place like Afghanistan with twice the population of Vietnam, with mountains much higher than anything in Vietnam, and with a supply line that you can't get there from here? What makes us think that we can, quote, prevail, end quote, there with 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 troops? It's lunacy.
It is, is the, you know, it is this neocon, proto-Zionist, I don't know what you would call it. It's just horrible, horrible, bloody occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan that is, should be, all of you listeners, perplexing us and making us challenge us to challenge our leaders to do what we need to do. You know, I purposely put a photograph of Mr. McGovern on the blog at the top of my daily ticker, infamously named the Fighting Cock, of him and David Swanson. And I did that on purpose because, well, one, it was available, and two, it was a representation of a man who came out and started talking. Mr. McGovern, I want to thank you so much for coming on my show, because really, I know I was listening to a half-hour show just yesterday preparing for this show with you. It was a Oscar-nominated documentary in Hollywood called The Most Dangerous Man in America, about Daniel Ellsberg from this period of time that Mr. McGovern's talking about. And it was an interview with Rick Goldsmith, who's the director and producer of that documentary. And I was listening to that for 30 minutes, and I thought, I think I am about, and you have listened to, in my opinion, one of the most dangerous men in America today, and that is Mr. Ray McGovern. And I want to thank you again. The clock is chiming. I want to thank you for appearing again on Radio Free Kansas. From the bottom of my heart, Mr. McGovern.
Well, thank you, Mike, and kudos to you, because what people can't get from the fawning corporate media, they can get from you, and I appreciate the chance to try to spread some truth around.
And thank you for staying on with me and taking my callers and giving us this in-depth analysis. I said, where would you go? What would you do to talk to a man who's given presidential briefs, who's worked on this stuff? Thank you. Thank you. Ray, thank you.
Welcome, Mike.
Goodbye.
Bye now.
Folks, I want to impress upon you the importance of checking out Radio Free Kansas regularly. You can email me and get the program schedule at bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. Again, that's all one word, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. I want to close this show. Well, call me a romantic. Call me an Irishman. Call me whatever you want. Call me a podunk. But I'm going to close this show with a song that is something my mother would sing regularly, and I love her, and I think of her. whenever I play this song. I'm going to close the show with a song that came out in 1905, and it was a song really, you know, I listened to it, and I thought, well, wait a minute, this would not be considered patriotic, but it's sung today in American Legion Hall in every VFW post. It's sung at baseball and sports stadiums. Let me see if I can find it here. And I want to close the show with it because I think it's appropriate. It really is. Oh, I don't know if I got it up here. I put it up here a long time ago. Oh, my goodness. But I want to really impress upon you the importance of people thinking for themselves. And so we need to use our history, use our understanding of history, unexpurgated, and try to bring it to us to share with our neighbors and friends. It's vitally important today that we do that. I can't find it. It's Billy Murray, A Grand Old Flag. Instead, I'll play my theme song, the Missouri Dog Song, dedicated to
once me Lamb Briggs and old Bill Brown took the load of corn to town, and old Jim Dobbs, the ornery cuss, he just naturally followed us. As we drove past Sam Johnson's store, past the apps came out the door. When Jim, he stopped to smell a box, they shied at him a bunch of rocks. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around. They tied a tin can to his tail and run him past the county jail. And that plum naturally makes me sore, and Lem he cussed and Bill he swore. Me, Lem Briggs and old Bill Brown, we lost no time in a jumping down, and we wiped them ducks up on the ground for kicking my old dog around. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around. Folks say a dog can't hold no grudge, but once when I got too much fudge, them pound ups tried to do me up, but they didn't count on old Jim Pup. Jim seed his duty far and thin, and he lit into them gentlemen, and he sure must up the coat house squaw with rags and meat and hide and haw. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around.